These lectures are titled Biology and Human Behavior, The Neurological Origins of Individuality, Part 2. Lecture 13, What Do Genes Do? Microevolution of Genes.
Welcome back. I hope you are energized and ready to take particularly good notes, because everything I'm going to tell you in this lecture is wrong. Well, actually, only some of it is wrong, but parts are true, and I got to tell you the wrong parts to prepare you for the next lecture when you get to see what's actually going on. But all of this is a transition from what we've learned so far. Okay, what have we done? We have seen how the brain works from the single cell up to the whole level and how it creates behavior. And then in the last three lectures, we transitioned to looking at where did this brain come from? Where did this brain come from? Our new bucket, our new category, how does evolution sculpt the brain? And as we've just been hearing as a hint, what's the intervening step in there? How does evolution, by way of changes in genes, sculpt the brain? And at the beginning of that evolution stretch, three lectures ago, we went through what seemed like a totally straightforward series of steps. Okay, how did the giraffe get its long neck? Number one, neck length has to have some sort of genetic component. Number two, there's got to be variation in that genetic component from one individual to the next. And then there has to be selection, the better versions of that genetic component. The individual bearing that passes on more copies of their genes, blah, blah. And from that, we did the very easy jump to the evolution of optimal behavior. As long as there is some genetic component to behavior, variability, off you go, very simple. But it's at this point that all sorts of people take very, very strong criticism, that assumption in there. What do genes have to do with behavior? What's that assumption about there's a gene for anything, or there's even a genetic influence for? And this is wildly controversial. And there's whole realms of science where people are identifying all sorts of genes for certain behaviors. This was summarized in a great cartoon I saw recently. It shows these two scientists at the lab bench, your stereotypical scientists in their lab coats and futzing around with their test tubes or whatever. And one of them is turning to the other saying, you know how you're on the phone with somebody and you've been on for a long time, and finally they say, well, I should let you go, even though you haven't said anything. You know, really, they actually want to get off the phone, but they don't really want to say that. I think I found the gene for that. And that kind of summarizes that whole approach, the gene for. And before we get into the question that will dominate some coming lectures, which is, what exactly my genes have to do with behavior, we have to suddenly stop and in a different discipline's bucket ask, what are genes anyway? How do they evolve? And what are genes? What are these things that are the intervening step in evolution and behavior that comes out the other end? And what we'll see initially is genes seem to have absolutely nothing to do with behavior. There are these sort of molecular little steps there, and we need to see that in order to begin to appreciate how they evolve and how they can evolve in ways relevant to all that brain stuff we heard about in all those early lectures. Okay, so we start off, in order to understand what genes do, we've got to understand what something else does in our cells, proteins. We've heard about proteins, and proteins implicitly have been central to a huge amount of stuff we've been covering. Okay, what is a protein? A protein is a long string of a molecule made up of a bunch of building blocks. And these building blocks are called amino acids, the same sort of things you can buy down there at the health food store, amino acids. These are the building blocks, and the amino acid alphabet has roughly 20 different types of amino acids, and is shown in this diagram. Here we have our schematic version of a whole bunch of the different flavors, the different types of amino acids. And what a protein is simply a whole string of amino acids looped together into this long string. A protein is just a whole long sequence of amino acids. Boring. Now, what the critical thing here is, depending on which amino acid, what letter of the amino acid alphabet you're using, it has a slightly different shape. And that's for some complex reasons in chemistry, not worth going into. It has a slightly different shape. So that when you string together a whole bunch of amino acids, that determines the shape of the protein. And depending on what the string is, you will get a slightly different shape, and with 20 different amino acid letters, and proteins being 500, 5,000 amino acids long, each protein is going to have a distinctive shape. And the central concept in this whole field of protein biochemistry is shape is destiny, shape is function. The shape of a protein determines what it does. And we've got this imaginary protein, which has a certain shape, and it just happens to loop around, and that shape is determined by its amino acid sequence. And what we see is that shape just happens to take a form where what does it begin to look like? Our stereotypical receptor, our neurotransmitter key going into a receptor lock, our hormone key going into a receptor lock. And the whole concept that ran through those is you've got to have a very specific shape to your lock. You have a very specific protein shape to do this. So we see this flow of sort of molecular determinacy. If you know the amino acid sequence of a protein, you are going to know the shape of the protein, and know the shape of the protein, and you're going to know a lot about its function. Amino acid sequence directs the function of proteins. And the proteins are relevant to everything we've been hearing about. All of those neurotransmitters are typically protein in nature. Lots of those hormones are, as we heard. Those receptors are made of proteins. The enzymes that rip apart the neurotransmitters, the enzymes that construct them, proteins are central to all the stuff going on in cells, including all those neurons we've come to know and love. So, of course, we now have the next question. Who tells the amino acids how to get strung together? Where do the instructions come for as to how to put together your amino acids to determine your proteins, and off you go from there? And this is where the genes come in. To summarize, this whole thing is your genes are the instructions as to how to string together your amino acids. Let's look at that in more detail. Genes are made of DNA, DNA coming in its long, long strings. DNA, what's DNA? It's the same concept as with proteins. DNA is made up of its own building blocks. And in the case of DNA, it's a four-letter alphabet. There's four different types of nucleotides. Don't worry about the term. DNA language, the long string of DNA messages, come in the form of four different building blocks strung together. And you could do the math. Once you have a single gene coded for, 10,000 long of these letters, four different possible ones in each spot, there's just a vastly enormous number of different types of genes coding for different proteins, coding for their function. And what we see here is it just happens the way the DNA code has evolved. Every three of those letters in a row specifies one amino acid. That's simply the coding for it. Three of those letters in the DNA language codes for one amino acid. So a long sequence of DNA codes for the long sequence of amino acids you're going to put together and thus make your protein. And what you've got at that point is a simple relationship. The string of DNA letters that codes for a single protein, that string of DNA letters is called a gene. A gene is the stretch of DNA that specifies one single protein. And you get a couple of complications there. There's a three-letter DNA word which tells you we're at the beginning of a protein, this starts a new one. And at the other end, there's a different three-letter one, which is a stop sequence, tells you you're done with it. And that's the flow of information. And this is the central dogma of life. This was a term that emerged in the 1960s after Watson and Crick came up with the structure of DNA, and it was worked out how the information flows. Information flows from DNA and its sequence of letters to ultimately protein and their function. And what you then have is a very sort of logical sequence. You've got your string of DNA, and you've got them thousands and thousands and millions and billions of these letters long. And each stretch of DNA that constitutes a gene then codes for a certain protein. And shown here in this diagram, we've got our looping, our helical DNA. And you know if you magnify it enormously, it's going to be long strings of this four-letter alphabet. And this stretch, beginning with its start signal and its stop signal, codes for protein A, which is shown here as a receptor. Next to it is protein B, coded for by gene B, in this case, a protein neurotransmitter. The next one is a channel. You remember back when calcium goes flowing into a cell to do that long-term potentiation stuff. There's got to be sort of this gate that opens up, which allows calcium to flow in, a calcium channel is the term. That's another one of those proteins. Stretch of DNA coding for three genes in a row, thus coding for three different proteins. And what you wind up getting is, just because there's such a staggeringly large number of genes, it winds up being a little bit cumbersome to have them all in one single long stretch. It simply evolved that you have your enormous DNA library broken up into separate volumes. Each separate one is called a chromosome. And it just picks up from there, and different species have different number of chromosomes, variability there. And what you wind up getting is, when you look at us, we've got about 30,000 different genes. And that's an enormous amount. Okay, so that's the flow of information from DNA to proteins. One extra small step in there, and this is one that simply happens, and this is how it's evolved, and it's not terribly interesting from the standpoint of the flow of information here. Stay tuned for the next lecture, but at this point it's not terribly interesting. Okay, you've got your one huge copy of your multi-volume set of DNA sitting there in the center of your cell, your nucleus. And what you wind up getting there is you're making proteins all over the place. Back to our neurons, you've got outposts of neurons, your axon terminals that are 3 feet down your spine. Parts of the cell are 3 feet away from the nucleus, and even your normal run-of-the-mill cell that's not so outrageously large and wandering all over the place as a neuron, it's still a pretty big thing. It's very cumbersome to make all the protein right there in your nucleus, off of your single set of DNA volumes, and then ship them out to all the different places in the cell. There just happens to evolve an intervening step, the stuff called RNA. And RNA is not terribly interesting. All RNA basically is a photocopy of the DNA, a stretch specifying a particular gene, and then it's actually the RNA that gets shipped out all over the cell, which then specifies the amino acids. And you've got your DNA sitting there in the center, your archetypal double helix sitting there in the nucleus, and you make your copies of your RNA there, and the RNA are shipped down the line, down the axon, out to the dendrites, whatever, where locally it's converted into protein. So this is the famed central dogma of life. Information flows from DNA to RNA to proteins. And thus you get this sort of dogmatic view in there. If you know the DNA sequence, that will let you predict the RNA sequence, that will let you predict the amino acid sequence in the protein, which determines shape, which determines function. So that is where you get from DNA, from a gene, to specifying protein function. And you could begin to see those proteins are everything we talk about in here in all those neurobiology lectures, making the neurotransmitters, breaking them down, receptors for, et cetera, et cetera. DNA, genes coding for that. And you better bet where we're going to go in subsequent lectures is seeing how much DNA is not the centerpiece of the central dogma of life, how much it is not the starting point of flow of information, dramatic foreshadowing all the ways in which environment regulate how those genes specify the RNA, the protein, off you go. But for this moment, what we are dealing with is this concept. You start with DNA, and that down the line is going to tell you what your protein shape and function is. Great. Okay, so this is modern molecular biology, and now what we have to do is merge this in with our last three lectures. What does evolution have to do with all this stuff we just heard about? What does evolution have to do with DNA and RNA and amino acids? And stated very simply, what evolution is, we know before, changes in patterns of genes, changes of distribution of genes and populations. What evolution is about is a change in the sequence of DNA. And this is the centerpiece of it. This is what evolution is. It changes the sequence of DNA. Why does this happen? Remember back to starting those evolution lectures where it's the giraffe get its long neck. A prerequisite is that the trait has some genetic component, and this is right where we're dwelling. Step number three was that you get selection going on. What was the critical step number two? That there's variability in genes and their traits from one individual to the next. Let's define that now in the terms we've just learned, that there's variability in DNA sequences. And for starters, what we have to ask is, where does this variability come from? What do we mean by variability? A change in the DNA sequence, a change in that four-letter alphabet. What causes those changes? That's what a mutation is. A mutation is a mistake in an egg or a sperm so that the DNA sequence has a typo is slightly different than the version that it came from in the parent. This could be due to just some enzyme that does DNA copying messing up, or it could be done due to something in the environment that triggers a mutation, a carcinogen. Ultraviolet radiation does that after a while to your skin, not a good thing. A mutation is simply a change in the sequence of DNA. And what we then have is step number two in that evolution business. You have to have a trait that has a genetic component. You have to have a source of variability, and this is what a mutation is, and then off you go. Does your version work better than the next individual's? That will determine how many copies of your genes are passed on, all that sort of stuff. All right, so mutations. A mutation is a mistake in a DNA sequence. We've just seen a couple of ways where that can come from. So the question becomes, what forms do these mutations take? And here we have classical genetics, genetics in terms of mutations in DNA sequences. This is the stuff our great-great-great-grandparents learned out in the prairie. This is classical mutations, and as we'll see, this is a very small part of the story, but this is what they work like, these classical forms. And we have some DNA message. We've got some gene, and we're looking for one stretch of that gene which codes for a message. I will now do this. I will now make more of this protein. I will now do this or that to this receptor. Some message there, I will now do this. And now we have the three different classical versions of mutations. You can have something called an insertion mutation. You've got this message, I will now do this, now, N-O-W. And thanks to this insertion mutation, you insert an extra message in there. You double the W. I will now, N-O-W, and now shifting over, I will now do this, now do, instead of D-O being spelled D-O, do the extra W. This next word is now W-D, and that's gibberish. The O is shifted over to the this. What an insertion mutation does is reduce your DNA sequence to coding for a protein that's gibberish. Massive mutation, not a good thing. You have shifted the entire message over by one letter, that duplicated letter, and it produces gibberish. Now, the next version produces gibberish as well. It's the opposite. It's called a deletion mutation. And in this case, one of the letters drops out. In making a copy of that DNA, it got lost along the way. This carcinogen wiped out that one letter in that sequence. You've now dropped out the W of now. I will now do this. And now the D has been shifted over. I will nod that. And then the T from this is shifted over. I will nod. And then the next word is OT. Once again, gibberish. Insertion mutations and deletion mutations tend to be disasters. You produce a protein that bears no resemblance to what the real one is, and the odds of that new protein making sense, having a rational function, let alone a rational function that's more advantageous than if you didn't have the mutation, is like one chance in a gazillion. Now, the third classical type of mutation is the most interesting one, and this one is called a point mutation. You don't double a letter. You don't drop out a letter, you just change one of the letters. You've just made a typo. You've made a typo and you've copied the letter incorrectly, and it's now a different letter. Instead of I will now do this, you've mutated a point mutation, the W of now to a T, and we now have a very different message. I will now do this, going to I will not do this. I actually once had a point mutation like this in a grant proposal of mine where summarizing after 400 pages at the end, instead of saying I will now do these studies, I will not do these studies. And, you know, no wonder it didn't get funded. A point mutation can be highly consequential. You can get something that works very differently then. So you've got these point mutations, insertion mutations, deletion mutations. We see a mechanism for it, the ways in which you get a mutation, and you see at this point our next question. We've now gotten to step two in classic Darwinian evolution. Step number one, there's got to be a trait that has a genetic component. By definition, if we're talking neurotransmitters and neurotransmitter receptors and channels and enzymes, these are traits that are highly, highly genetically influenced. Foreshadowing, we will see the ways in which it's not entirely genetically influenced, but we've just sort of fit criterion number one. We have traits all over the brain in which there are genetic components, and we've just seen trait number two which is we have a source of variability. These little bits of micro mutations, just one little gene there shifted to the right, an insertion mutation shifted to the left, the deletion mutation, disasters for that protein, but a very local little mutation, or even much more subtle here, a point mutation, just one letter being different. And we could run with that one already back to our central dogma. DNA determines RNA, determines protein, determines sequence, determines shape, function, and this is going to be a protein that functions differently. Now, you could have made a typo with your point mutation and had a different letter now in your genetic sequence and changed from now to not. That's a big one. The word not means something very different from the word now, and it changes the entire message. You could have inadvertently made your local little point mutation and coded for a different amino acid that almost has the same shape as the original one. And as a result, the protein has a slightly different shape and a slightly different function, or you can have your massive point mutation from I will now to I will not, and that one is consequential. So it's not only that you've made a mistake in the amino acid that you code for, but which particular one, how does that change the function? And it's right at that point that we introduce our step number 3 in our Darwinian sequence, a trait that has a genetic component, a source of variability, and at that point, natural selection, Darwin's major contribution, takes over. You have a different version of that protein than the rest of the kids on your block. Is that more advantageous to you? More advantageous. What was the term that came out of Darwin, which, by the way, Darwin never once said? This was a social Darwinist a few generations later. Survival of the fittest. We now know that's nonsense from the last 3 lectures. It's not survival of the fittest, it's reproduction of the fittest, passing on copies of your genes. Another sort of caveat there, Darwin did not invent the concept of evolution, that species change over time. That had been around for a long time before that. He came up with a notion that, how do they change? Natural selection. So natural selection at that Darwinian level, and our last 3 lectures of the evolution of this aspect of sociality or cooperativity or whatever, how does natural selection now play out on the level of these proteins and genes and all these little reductive nuts and bolts we've been looking at? And here we see an example of it. We've got some cell with a receptor, and we can easily imagine it being one of our neurons and a receptor for a neurotransmitter or a hormone. And we've got the receptor and the messenger, the neurotransmitter hormone, fitting in there ad nauseum, the key fitting into the lock. And you've got the sort of thing that biochemists pay attention to at this point, which is how well does that messenger fit into the receptor? How long does it stay in there before it comes floating off? Remember that neurotransmitter lecture? After it floats off, you can recycle it, you could break it down. Prerequisite of those pathways is it floats off. The receptor has a certain affinity for the messenger. It holds onto it for a certain length of time. And the shape of the receptor determines how long it holds onto it, and thus how much of an oomph that messenger has in the target cell, what changes it causes, how big, how long. So you can see just where we're going. The shape of that protein receptor determines how much that cell listens to that messenger, how much of an impact it has, how long calcium flows in, things of that sort. The shape of the receptor, the affinity that it has for the messenger that it binds, determines how well it transmits that message. So now we look at mutations, and the mutations, the classical ones we know about, deletion, insertion, point mutations, and we look at what they might do to a protein like that. In the first case, we've got a deletion mutation, and thanks to the deletion, we've gotten as far as I will, and then the now has become gibberish and all the words after that. We've truncated the protein. We've got this receptor now that only has one half of it, and what you've got is, what's your affinity? There's no affinity. It's not going to bind that neurotransmitter messenger. How long is that messenger now going to have an effect on that cell? 0 seconds, no effect whatsoever. This deletion mutation has knocked that receptor out of business. you remember back to that absolutely wild mutation we heard about, where thanks to a testosterone receptor having a mutation, somebody who is genetically a male, gonadally a male, hormonally a male, nonetheless looks exactly like a female down to every bit of anatomy, that testicular feminization syndrome. Just one little mistake there in a testosterone receptor, and you have a very different looking mammal there. So here we have a case where there's no functional receptor, there's no ability of that messenger to have an effect on the cell. Next, we have our other big messy mutation, in this case an insertion mutation, and once again, we've got the message being gibberish and now a much longer one, and what you see here is there's this protein, but the latter half of it is a completely weird shape, and once again, that's a receptor that cannot bind that messenger. How much of an impact will that messenger have? Zero. There's no affinity. Now to our more subtle cases, we've got a point mutation. In the first case, it changes the shape of the receptor ever so slightly in the form of it being a little wider, a little bit less selective, having a lower affinity for that messenger. And what do you see? What used to be 5 seconds worth of calcium influx into that cell has now been reduced to 3 seconds, and maybe that's something maladaptive, and this is an organism now that is less likely to pass on copies of its genes. Meanwhile, we've got another point mutation that increases the affinity of that receptor, and thus instead of 5 seconds of calcium flow, we've got 10 seconds, and our smiley face logo, suppose that's an advantageous thing. That's an organism now who's going to leave more copies of its genes. We see exactly how this works. And this is a classical picture of how you turn evolution, like in the last three lectures, into molecular biology, changes on the level of the cell. And this approach to it is what's called microevolution. The notion you get these tiny little changes, an evolutionary change, so this receptor holds on to its messenger 3% longer or 3% shorter, or this enzyme works 2% faster, these tiny little changes, so that over the course of evolution, you have these very gradual changes of distribution of genes in a population, what is called incrementalism. The notion that evolutionary change is virtually constant, but in these very, very tiny steps. And what would be a classic example of that, where it's relevant to the sort of neurobiology we learned? Back to the whole notion of anxiety. Some individuals are more anxious than others. Anxiety has a genetic component. Anxiety disorders are somewhat heritable. Heritable, we're talking genes, we're talking DNA sequences, and back to a chemical messenger which reduces anxiety. And this is a chemical in the brain which structurally looks a whole lot like Valium and Librium, these things called benzodiazepines. Don't worry about the term there. But of course, you know what comes next. Benzodiazepines bind to benzodiazepine receptors. And thus, we've got an evolutionary question of how well, how sensitive does that receptor work? How much does a anti-anxiety benzodiazepine signal turn into these neural pathways mediating less anxiety? And what you begin to see is there are all sorts of rat strains out there that differ genetically in their propensity towards anxiety. You have anxiety-prone rat strains, and they get high blood pressure, and they get ulcers, and people really study these guys for a living. They have been bred to be high anxiety, low anxiety. How do you breed to be high or low? You are breeding to have certain mutations passed on more readily than others. Aha, whichever rat of this litter has the highest levels of anxiety, that's the only one you're going to allow to breed. You are artificially, through artificial selection, passing on this trait. You are selecting for different DNA sequences in your benzodiazepine receptors that are a little bit better, a little bit worse at binding on to the benzodiazepines. And it's that realm where you can now begin to imagine the DNA changes that make one person's enzyme in this realm a little bit better, a little bit slower, a little bit whatever. And there goes natural selection at that point, deciding which assemblage of genetic traits are more adaptive than others, who's passing on the most copies of their genes. Now, as promised, virtually everything you've heard in the last 29 and a half minutes is incorrect, simply because this view of evolution is about these tiny little microevolutionary incremental changes turns out to be only a very small part of the story. And what we will see in the next lecture is, number one, how much of evolutionary change is instead in big lurching macroevolutionary steps. And number two, we will see some absolutely wild, unexpected mechanisms where you've got mutations that are not about these diddly little point mutations, but instead crazy, massive changes in DNA sequences, and that's where a whole lot of evolution comes from, relatively real fast and real dramatically. So that's going to be our next lecture.